This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by RingCentral, cloud business phone systems designed to meet the needs of today's mobile and distributed workforces. Learn more at ringcentral.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve does more than just interest rates, you know. Janet Yellen actually gave a speech today in which she reminded all of us to save for a rainy day. We'll talk about space rockets, too, and beer, of course. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by ClearFit. Used by growing businesses, ClearFit is designed to make it easy to find and hire employees that succeed. More at clearfit.com. And by MailChimp. More than 6 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here, everybody. It's a Thursday, the 18th of September. And I know we started with Janet Yellen yesterday, kind of had to, right, what with the Fed meeting and all. But we are going to get going with her again today because she gave a speech this morning in which she quoted a remarkable statistic. Drawing on a Fed study of the state of low and middle income family finances, Dr. Yellen pointed out that for almost half of the families in this country, an unexpected expense of just $400 would basically break the bank. They would have to borrow money, sell something, or simply not pay at all. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes it from there.
It's been a familiar story during the Great Recession and not-so-great recovery. Someone loses a job or can't go to work because of a serious illness, and they can't cover basic bills. Andrea Levere is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, which is behind the latest research on financial insecurity. She says it affects not just the poor, those who are unemployed or working minimum wage.
25% of American households in the fourth quintile of income, which is roughly $50,000 to $90,000, are in liquid asset poverty.
Liquid asset poverty, meaning they don't have the $6,000 or so in savings or assets they could sell right away to live at the poverty level for 3 months. Randy Albelda, an economist at UMass Boston, isn't surprised.
Given the very slow recovery for most people, given the last 20 years of very slow income growth for the bottom 50%, people have depleted all their savings.
And what could help? A major factor turns out to be whether there are banks in poor neighborhoods and whether working people use them. In cities like Newark, New Jersey, where a lot of people don't have a savings or checking account, more people are financially on the brink.
On average, an unbanked person spends $1,000 a year on financial services, getting their checks cashed, right, because they don't have a bank account, going to payday lenders or to rent-to-own.
Bottom line, it's expensive to be poor. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not to belabor a theme here, but we are going to go back to that Fed meeting from yesterday for this next story. The Federal Open Market Committee, as you know, did nothing on interest rates in large measure because inflation is doing nothing in this economy. And yet members of that committee and other high-level economists almost everywhere talk about inflation all the time. To understand why that is, you got to know your history, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains.
If your experience of the 1970s is that TV show with Ashton Kutcher in bell bottoms, know this. For millions of Americans, the 70s was no comedy. Take Bob Donahue. His dad retired in 1972 with a pension of $120 a month.
My father's pension check, which was fixed in its amount, covered his rent for 2 months when he retired. less than 7 years later, that same pension check only covered 2 weeks' worth of rent on the same apartment.
In the 70s, oil prices more than quadrupled. Mortgage rates hit double digits. Just ask economist Alan Sinai.
I was stuck with one mortgage on a primary residence at 17% into the 1980s.
And talk about sticker shock. The inflation rate went from 5.7 to 13.5% in just 4 years. Just for comparison, last year's was a measly 1.5%.
I try to forget about my experience with the 1970s.
Barry Bosworth was working for Jimmy Carter in the late 70s. He directed the Council on Wage and Price Stability. He remembers trying to persuade companies to freeze prices and unions to hold down wage demands.
Trying to restrain inflation by talking about it didn't work.
What did work was tightening the money supply. Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, under President Reagan, cracked down on runaway inflation, but the costs were enormous, a recession that threw millions of Americans out of work.
I think the experience of the 1970s convinced people that the cost of stopping an inflation are high once it gets ingrained into our day-to-day behavior.
Even if right now inflation feels as dated as, well, Ashton Kutcher in bell bottoms. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
All sunshine and light on Wall Street today as traders wait for that Alibaba IPO tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're looking at television this week, how we watch it, how it gets made, and what the future of it might be. It's a series we're calling Screen Wars.
Television.
Got this. No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
The tracking firm Live States tells us that the internet, as of this very week, now consists of over a billion websites. It is a crowded internet marketplace indeed, where it's getting ever tougher to stand out. One way sites are doing that is by something as simple as their web address, specifically the .tv domain name. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
Tell me about .tv. Make me smart.
Well, you know, it's a suffix. Yeah. It is a, you know, one of these things they call the top level domain.
Yep.
It's the thing that goes to the right of the dot. And it's really sort of about branding, and it's about the vast expanding internet as we know it. Now, you remember earlier this year, a bunch of new top-level domains were released, .nyc, .sports,
yeah.
.bike. So .tv is another one of these domains that hasn't really been built out yet, and a lot of new media companies are heading there to host their content.
Here comes a perhaps naive question. How much does .tv actually have to do with TV?
It has to do with TV more and more because, of course, web video is this another growing part of the internet and fast growing, right?
Yep.
But really, it's connected more to this tiny Pacific island nation, Tuvalu. You know how .uk is, you know, our friends across the
yes.
pond, .us here in the U.S. Tuvalu, you know, 10 square miles, population 11,000. Other than that domain suffix the country owns, it doesn't have a ton to
right.
do with television
right.
production, right? But Tuvalu does actually get, by some estimates, as much as $4 million a year for
wow.
leasing out .tv,
wow.
which could be about 10% of the nation's GDP, which
huh.
is, you know, it's a nice chunk of change.
Can I find things on a .tv website that I cannot necessarily find on a .com website?
Only in a very sort of simple way. You know, what is actually changing here that I think is really interesting is the network infrastructure. And I think now that I think is a little bit more compelling than just the .tv part of this.
And when you say networks, you're not talking about television networks. You're talking about the back end, the network as an internet network.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I said, video, it's a vastly expanding area of our vastly expanding internet. Cisco estimates 70% of total internet traffic by the year 2017 is going to be video. And a lot of that's going to be mobile video. So I actually went to Bell Labs in New Jersey this week to hang out with some of the nerds over there. And
you have the best job, man. Come on.
They've got some nice telephones, too. One of the guys that's there, he's affectionately called their wireless guru. His name is Todd Sizer. He's actually thinking a lot about changing the way networks deal with this video and video buffering. So say you're a passenger in the seat of a car, or maybe you're on a train in the future, in the near future, and you're about to go into a tunnel. Now, the people designing the networks of the future want you to be able to watch your television in the tunnel, so they want to use the GPS on your device to tell the network that you're going underground, and then they want the network to deliver you more data faster before you go into the tunnel.
Wow. So it buffers while you're underground.
Exactly.
Wow.
Well, it buffers actually
before you're underground, and then it plays.
Exactly. So I think actually, you know, whether you're a .tv website, a .com website, there's more and more web video and web video companies all the time. And a lot of those companies are going to be looking at this kind of tweak to the actual infrastructure behind the website to make that happen for you.
Ben, one last thing before I let you go. Larry Ellison, founder and CEO of Oracle, is gonna have a new job, we learned late this afternoon. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't seem like a ton is necessarily going to change here, right? Ellison is still going to be at Oracle, and, you know, he's always been imagined as a major part of this company and with the company. And this is part of a larger trend. Think Bill Gates standing not too far behind Satya Nadella at Microsoft.
Right.
You know, the old guard leaves but doesn't go entirely out the door and passes the baton to some young people within the company.
He will also be chief technology officer still. Mark Hurd, formerly of Hewlett-Packard, and Safra Katz are going to take over as co-CEOs at Oracle. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks very much.
You got it, Kai.
You can check out our whole series, Screen Wars, about the future of television at our website, marketplace.org. And now the battle of the space race billionaires. As you might have heard earlier this week, SpaceX, the company founded by Elon Musk, he also of the electric car company Tesla, got a $2.5 billion contract with NASA to ferry astronauts up to the space station and back, one presumes. Yesterday, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, who has his own spaceship enterprise called Blue Origin, got a deal to supply rocket engines. So, is there actual money to be made in space, or is this just rich guys messing around because they can? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
First, there are a couple of big reasons to take on these kind of projects. To start with, the launch technology we use now is like 40 years old. It's like the Atari 2600 of rockets. Here's Jim Bell, a professor at the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State.
The existing generation of traditional engines are the Ataris of their time. And there's a whole bunch of startups out there, Blue Origin being one of them, SpaceX being another one, that are building our modern Xboxes.
Also, the rocket engines we've been using since the 1990s are from Russia. Ever since the whole Ukraine situation flared up, that's been making policymakers pretty nervous. And there is money in space, mostly in selling satellite services like TV and GPS, not so much in launch technology. Carissa Christensen is managing partner at the Tory Group, a consultancy that looks at space technology.
Space is a little like the movie business. Nobody is in it by accident. Everyone desperately wants to be doing it. There are three people behind every person who's making money at it who like to be involved in the industry, and part of it is because of the allure of it. It's fascinating.
Startups looking to do next-generation space tech, she says she's seen generations of them. She also says this one's different.
Because the people who are starting these companies are not simply doing it to build the coolest rocket that they can. They are doing it to prove that you can make money in space. They are doing it with very deep pockets. They are doing it with business expertise from outside the space industry.
And, she says, they're succeeding. May the best billionaire win. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Scarcity breeds demand. That's not by design for us.
Oh, sure, it's not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 109 points today, 0.6%, closed at a record 17,265. The NASDAQ advanced 31 points, 0.2%, 45.93. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 2011. That is another record. Food giant ConAgra chomped up 4.5% today. Its quarterly profits nearly tripled on lower expenses. AOL clicked up 3.3%. An analyst at BCG Partners suggested Yahoo might make a bid for the veteran internet company. Yahoo down more than 1%. No confirmation of that potential Yahoo bid or not, by the way. Bond prices, while they fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.61%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duff & Phelps, the global valuation and corporate finance advisor, balancing technical knowledge and market insight to help clients make sound decisions. DuffandPhelps.com. By Nuance Power PDF, designed to easily convert, combine, and edit documents for your small business. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions to help organizations of all types and sizes achieve their strategic goals. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Ceremonies across the nation honor prisoners of war and those still missing in action. The third Friday of September is designated as National POW MIA Recognition Day. The Conference Board releases its latest index of leading economic indicators, and you might have heard him ask famous people to tell us their favorite curse word. Television's Inside the Actors Studio host James Lipton turns 88. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're in the business of higher education, and honestly, probably even if you're not, you're aware of the increasing focus on how colleges and universities are handling sexual assaults on campus. 70 schools, plus or minus, are under investigation for the way that they treat that issue. And tomorrow, the White House is expected to unveil a nationwide plan to do something about it. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
You don't have to look any farther than the University of California, Berkeley, to see that sexual violence is a top concern. This fall, the school made its sexual violence training mandatory. All but 500 students showed up. School spokesperson Claire Holmes says the clock is ticking for the no-shows.
If they do not complete the training by October 1st, then we will put a hold on their registration for the spring semester.
Schools around the nation have gotten the memo, says Terry Hartle with the American Council on Education. It's certainly in university and college's long-term financial interest to toughen up their response to sexual assault. Hartle says he's seen a dramatic rise in student, faculty, and security training.
That is clearly the most obvious immediate action. It is also in many ways the easiest.
Hartle says finding ways to investigate and resolve these cases is a more complicated and difficult challenge. Schools out of compliance with federal Title IX rules could lose funding for student aid, and that's putting pressure on colleges and universities to act. Attorney Carrie Simon says a cottage industry is sprouting up, and she warns it's a seller's market.
We're seeing folks that are kind of calling themselves trainers or experts who maybe haven't been around all that long saying, you know, pay me this and I'll get you in compliance. But it's really about checking the box and not about getting to the heart of the issues and changing rape culture.
The question is, how will prospective students and their parents know if a school is safe or not? Simon says it's incumbent on us to be smart consumers and research policies and procedures before ever stepping foot on campus. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Mm-hmm. There is, as we all know, a whole lot of money in the healthcare business. There is also, it turns out, a whole lot of money in the wellness business, specifically the business of corporate wellness programs. It's a $6 billion industry, despite, it turns out, no small amount of evidence that corporate wellness programs don't work as well as advertised. We call Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School every now and then to get a bit of perspective on things like these. Nancy, it's good to talk to you again.
It's always a pleasure, Kai.
So why is it, in the face of the evidence that, you know, wellness programs might not work all that well, shall we say, why do employers keep, you know, suggesting them and pouring money into them and all that?
You know, it's a great question. And the, you know, most recent counts have, you know, wellness programs being considered somewhat or very effective by something like 71% of the employers who use them. And that, by the way, is a big hunk. Lots of people buying them, and lots of people, lots of employers and managers, you know, patting themselves on the head for doing so. So here's what seems to be going on. Most of the effects are short term. Most of the effects around lifestyle changes, right? We pay you if you lose some weight,
right,
or we
stop,
you know,
smoking,
we make you
go
pay
to the
more,
gym, whatever.
Right. Exactly. Make you pay more if your body mass index is so high. All those kind of carrots and sticks don't seem to work too well. But there's a second thing that's actually even more important, and that is that all these carrot and sticks, all these incentives, all these hurdles, right, greatly increase the cost of testing employees. So these things net-net are more costly than we might think.
The cynic in me wonders whether, as employers are reducing their own healthcare costs, and that's what, you know, this survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation found last week, right? Healthcare costs are generally stable or going down. Employers are reducing their cost. What about employees? What about the workers, right?
So I think the cynic in you is dead on, Kai. You know, that is what's really happening in many instances is costs are actually getting shifted to employees, whether it's because they don't meet certain goals or they don't conform in certain ways. This is at some level some kind of shifting of the burden of healthcare costs from employers to a certain degree onto workers. So yeah, healthcare costs are going down for organizations, not necessarily going down for individuals and families.
And here's the other thing. I mean, we've got here at Marketplace, we have a wellness program. I frankly don't know what it is because I don't need the company to tell me to go work out and exercise. Yeah. And that's kind of it, right? You're going to exercise because you want to feel better and take care of yourself. You're not going to do it because somebody's going to give you $15 off your premium.
Again, I couldn't agree more, and the evidence corroborates what you're saying. And there is something going on that at a kind of, you know, deeper level that makes one just a tiny bit queasy. Your employer tells you when to work, and now your employer gets to decide on whether you are rewarded, you know, woof, woof, Pavlovian dog-like for reducing,
all right, well,
right, your body mass index.
Yeah.
I mean, there is – I'm not suggesting that that's the intentional. I'm suggesting there are those undertones to this.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Thank you, Nancy.
Always a pleasure.
What follows is a story about a product you quite possibly have never heard of. What makes it interesting is that that's almost completely by design. I'm not going to spoil it too much other than to say it's about an ancient Roman botanist and beer. Here's Marketplace's Queenie Kim.
Pliny the Elder was a Roman naturalist who's credited for first identifying hops. Pliny the Elder is a beer and a case study in scarcity marketing. Natalie Cherluzzo is a co-owner of the Russian River Brewery, which makes Pliny.
We don't do any advertising. As far as our marketing, I blog very infrequently on our website. We have a Facebook page. I try to post about once a week, maybe, you know.
Despite this, demand for its signature beer couldn't be greater. Cholurzo says on weekends, their brew pub in Santa Rosa is packed.
We usually have lines out front on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday mornings before we even open. I heard that yesterday the Google bus was here.
The brewery also sells bottles of Pliny in limited quantities to a couple hundred stores in California and Colorado. One of those stores is Ledger's in Berkeley. I got to Ledger's at 4 o'clock, which is when I was told Pliny gets delivered. Turns out the beer came early and they were already out. Aviv Gerber was one of the lucky ones. He's 29 and a bartender.
Hey, can I interview you?
Sure, can you follow me out to my car?
Gerber hadn't fed the meter, and on the way outside, he tells me somebody at the dog park told him about Pliny.
I heard it's only here on Wednesdays, and it's now limited one bottle per person, and I was curious.
Stores limit the number of Plinys you can buy because in the past, one guy would come in and buy the whole lot and anger customers. I walked back into the store and spotted Cole Yacko. He's 32 and works there. Ledger's is my neighborhood store, and so Cole hooked me up with a Pliny. He kept it under the counter and out of sight of the customers.
I'm trying to hide them. They can't see it. They'll get really mad.
I paid for mine and went home. And I have to say, the bottle is a little underwhelming. The label is super simple, and you could easily miss Pliny on a shelf. The beer is super dry, super hoppy, and totally worth the hassle of tracking it down.
Scarcity has this effect of making people perceive products as more valuable simply for the fact that they're scarce.
Nir Eyal is the author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He says it's not just psychological. Studies have shown it's physiological.
They took a look at what was happening inside people's brains when they were trying wine of different price points.
In other words, some wines were more valuable and scarce than others. Eyal says it's not just that people liked the most expensive wine,
but their brains actually perceived the wine differently when they were tasting the $90 wine versus the cheap wine. And then, of course, what they didn't tell these participants is that it was the same wine all along.
Eyal says what's happening is that one piece of information, that something is scarce, is short-circuiting the brain. There's also the fact that scarcity makes for a good story. Eyal says if you tell people, hey, this beer uses high-quality hops and is made in small batches, nobody's going to remember that.
However, if I tell you this crazy story about how you can only buy a limited amount, and can you believe it in the lines, that's a really good story, and it's very easy for one person to transmit to another.
Eyal says for scarcity marketing to work, the scarcity has to have, at the very least, an aura of legitimacy. And when it comes to Pliny the Elder, scarcity is more than an aura. Natalie Chalurzo says it's a reality.
Why don't you guys make more beer? You have the demand. Why not make more supply?
This has always been a lifestyle venture for us. You know, we're a married couple.
And Chalurzo says they looked into making more beer, but that would mean taking on more debt, more stress, and more work. And why bother?
Scarcity breeds demand. That's not by design for us.
But she says it's been a winning formula. In Santa Rosa, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Smartling, a translation software platform for launching websites, mobile applications, and business documents in other languages. More at smartling.com. By Moo.com, an online print and design company where you can make business cards, flyers, and triple thick luxe cards. Learn more at Moo.com. And by Emerald Data Solutions, whose BoardDocs web applications are designed to help governing bodies operate more effectively by eliminating paper and streamlining board packet processes. BoardDocs.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, we will have more from our TV series Screen Wars next week. But in the meanwhile, this quick item about television and how it's changing. The TV Guide Network is trying to move away from any lingering association consumers might make between it and TV Guide, the magazine and the website, and it is rebranding itself. The new name is POP. That's all caps, by the way. POP. The target demographic, the company says, is 18 to 54-year-olds who are socially engaged and connected and who have a thirst for pop culture. So says The Hollywood Reporter. There you have it.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.